catches that doggy in the window. The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that dog is for sale. I must take a trip to California and leave my poor sweetheart.
How much is that doggy in the window? And how much will that dog cost over the years of feeding, grooming, vaccinating, and caring for it? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. My guest is the co-author of a Cambridge University Press book entitled Dog Economics, Perspectives on Our Canine Relationships. David Wymer is the Witte Professor of Political Economy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he also teaches in the Robert La Follette School of Public Affairs. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
This is such a fascinating book, appealing both to those who love dogs and are interested in our relationship to dogs, and then anyone interested in the economy and how money works and how we put values on different things. What made you come up with this idea of writing a book about dog economics?
Well, it all began with some research I did on how much the implicit value people place on the lives of their dogs. You know, we have estimates from labor markets and other studies that tell us implicitly what value the average American places on his or her own life.
And when we're trying to figure out what value we put on our own life, is that in part needed so we can figure out if you sue somebody for taking someone else's life? Or why do we need to know the value on a life?
It actually does not apply to suing somebody. Where it's useful is in doing cost-benefit analyses of regulations. So a regulation may save a certain number of lives, and we want to be able to monetize those lives for purposes of comparing it to the cost of the regulation. And so the value we come up with is not how much an individual would pay to avoid death. It's how much the individual seems to be willing to pay to reduce small risks in mortality. And the way I like to think about it is once grandma falls and is in the hospital, you'll pay whatever you have to save her. But you don't necessarily go into her house and put railings up so she doesn't fall in the first place. It's that latter activity that we're trying to understand.
The idea of putting a value on a life, whether it's a person's life or a dog's life, it seems so, I don't know, like Bentham or Malthus or sort of utilitarian kind of calculated
well,
numbers.
It certainly is utilitarian. Uh-huh. But it's useful because we want to allocate resources in a way that maximizes social well-being. And that means trying to figure out how people are willing to trade off goods that they can consume with mortality risk. You know, whenever somebody drives above the speed limit, they're making an explicit trade-off between mortality risk and something they value, time, right? So we have a lot of ways of doing it for people, but we didn't have a way of doing it for dogs.
And why do we need one?
Well, if you may remember that around 2006, a lot of American dogs and cats died from the pet food they ate.
It was contaminated, right?
Yes, it was contaminated with melamine, which was an ingredient that was added to imports from China to make it appear to have more protein than it actually had. And in response, Congress gave the Food and Drug Administration authority to regulate pet food. In other words, since 1906, they've been able to regulate our food, but it was only in 2007 that the Food and Drug Administration gained authority to regulate pet food. But the problem in that is to write regulations, major regulations, they have to be justified with a cost-benefit analysis. So how do you value the avoided pet deaths? And I was at a meeting of the Society for Benefit-Cost Analysis at the time when the chief economist for the Food and Drug Administration was complaining that he didn't have a way to monetize these pet deaths. So it was very difficult to write the regulations and justify them. So I suggested a contingent valuation study, which is a survey method that would allow us to impute the value, the implicit value people are placing on their dogs' lives when they make decisions relevant to mortality of their dogs.
Such as whether they take them to the vet, pay for vaccines.
Right. Indeed, the experiment we did involved confronting people with the risk of canine influenza and then offering a vaccine at random prices. And that randomness allows us, in effect, to back out a demand schedule from which we can estimate the implicit value that the average dog owner is placing on their pet dog.
If I remember right from that chapter, you come up with a figure around $10,000 a dog?
The time we did it, it was about $10,000. Mm-hmm. Now it would be more like $12,000 or $13,000 because of inflation.
And that gives the sort of calculated numbers part of your book. But you also spend a lot of time about the love, the family-like relationship between people and dogs. And you have as your dedication page a picture of your own dog.
Right.
Can you talk about that side of writing the book? Because, yes, you have this research area looking at the value we place on a life and cost-benefit analysis, but there's more going on in this book than the numbers.
Yes, we hope there is, yes. Well, what makes dogs so interesting is many people view them as family members. And that's a very different commodity than the sorts of goods we usually consume, right? It gives a sort of almost personhood to the dog. And that means that we can't look just at dogs as another commodity. There's something special about them. And indeed, at some point we call it dog exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. It's the species with which we are closest. I don't want to offend cat owners here, but that means we delved into some of the literature on the economics of the family. And there's some empirical work that was done a number of years ago that suggests that dogs might be substitutes for very young children, but complements to older children. In our own research, we found that people often viewed dogs as a way of teaching their children responsibility, although my guess is in most cases it's the mother that ends up taking care of the dog. But that made it a very interesting topic for us.
You go into a lot of different directions in the book, from the way that if you're walking a dog, it might lead to your meeting a future partner, or, I mean, the health benefits of walking a dog and what happened with COVID and what happened if a particular movie fad came out for Dalmatians. We'll get into some of that later. But let's go to the early part, because you do spend time in the book looking at evolution and the transition from wolves to dogs, and why that might have happened so many thousands of years ago.
Yes. Probably 15,000 or more years ago. There are a lot of explanations for why wolves and people might have wanted to associate around each other. They're often viewed as potentially of being auxiliary hunters, for example. Helping to bring down prey, kill thieves. In other words, just wolves hang around because when we kill something, couldn't necessarily take it all away. They could be guards. There's about 10 different reasons you could give.
Keeping each other warm in the winter.
Keeping each other warm, yes. We've all familiar with the mm-hmm. with the name of the band, the Three Dog Night, right? What probably happened is people adopted puppies and raised them. When I say puppies, wolf pups, and raised them. And you can imagine a sort of selective breeding happening in which the more docile, friendly pups were kept and the others were allowed to run away or go away. This process could have happened quite quickly. We usually think of these evolutionary changes as being very slow. But there was an experiment in Russia where a team domesticated foxes. And basically, they were able to create dog-like foxes in about six generations. Hmm. That's amazingly fast from an evolutionary perspective. But then once dogs begin to become domesticated, then they can be both consumption and have consumption benefit, but also production benefit, right? They can provide the services we talked about that might have made them attractive to our ancestors, to our clans.
What's some of the early evidence that we see of dogs in societies used as pets?
Well, we see evidence from burials where people are buried with their dogs. And that's pretty good evidence that they had some important role. Beyond that, it's sort of hard. You know, we have to look at more contemporary societies to make imputations about what our ancestors were like and how they lived. But the tombs do provide evidence.
You talk about dogonomics, the big business, really the amount, the billions of dollars that are spent in America on pets in general, but particularly on dogs. Can you give us some overview of the scope of what we're talking about?
Yeah, well, about half of U.S. households have dogs. And the most recent survey estimates that the average household spends about $1,500 a year on a dog. Now, some households spend less, but some spend much more.
So that would include first purchasing the dog, or does this...
This is maintenance.
This is maintenance, not the acquisition.
Once you have the dog, on average, this is what you're spending for food, routine medical care, treats,
toys.
All toys, all the things.
Dog grooming, sitting, and boarding.
Exactly.
And so with that said, how does it affect the economy in any other way? Now, this is just, these are different businesses that provide the pet food or the dog grooming, the veterinarian that gives care. Does the fact that you have half of American households with a dog affect the economy in any other way?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. You already alluded to some of the social capital benefits of having a dog. You know, you walk your dog and you meet your neighbors who have dogs. Indeed, you meet many of your neighbors who don't have dogs but wish they had a dog. I would say that the economic impacts are more on the dog as working for the man, in a sense, the occupations that dogs fill. So they're not really pets per se. They are working dogs. And unfortunately, many dogs give their lives in medical research. So certainly there's an effect there.
So you've got dogs that are used in medical research, which is controversial. You have dogs as service dogs or dogs that are herding on a range or sort of the working dogs. You talk, when we talk about purchasing a dog, first of all, about the choice of breed, but also about some of the dangers in the for-profit area, like with puppy mills.
Yes, it's a very disturbing topic to look into. The cruelty to both the parental dogs and the puppies is substantial in many cases. And there are what economists call market failures involved. A market failure is where we don't expect free exchange to maximize social welfare. And one of these market failures...
Wait a minute, let me back you up. Yeah. So you don't expect free exchange...
And free markets, yeah.
Free market... How so? We don't expect...
Yeah. So there are things that interfere with that exchange maximizing value. So, for example, the two that come up with puppy mills, one is there's what we call an information asymmetry. And what that means is it's difficult for people who purchase puppies to know the care that the puppy received, and particularly the socialization that the puppy mm-hmm. received, which can affect its later life. So that's one problem that comes up. The other is externalities. That is, the puppy mills impose costs on the rest of society in their production process. So often they will simply release dogs that can no longer breed. They end up in shelters. The dogs that are not well socialized are more likely to not be successfully housed in a family. And they end up in shelters. And then, of course, the shelters bear costs and euthanize. I think the latest figure I've seen is U.S. shelters euthanize about 400,000 dogs per year.
Wow.
That's high. A lot.
That is a lot. And I know we'll talk about euthanasia in general for dogs, but wow, that's a lot that end up in the shelters. So if somebody wanting to purchase a puppy wants to avoid some of the, you know, really unsavory conditions, the unethical treatment of those puppies, how do you avoid the puppy mill part and get a dog that has been treated right?
Well, shelters, of course, will do some screening for you, right? And for an older dog, you may have a better sense of what the behaviors are going to be. There are also what we label ethical breeders, people who establish a reputation for taking care of the dogs and providing them the appropriate socialization. The downside there is, though, they often tend to be having breeds that may be overbred.
So the ones that are pedigree?
Pedigree, yes. And the pedigree doesn't guarantee the ancestry, but there can be a tendency to use the same dogs as parents. You know, you have a very attractive dog and you use it to sire many, many puppies. Well, that tends to reduce the genetic diversity and that can be a problem.
And how do you feel about the dog shows, the best dog that gets out of the Westminster Dog Show every year? And some of the owners seem very intense.
Yes, I'm not really into that. Although I couldn't resist looking at the poodle who won the last one.
But that's a different kind of purpose in having a dog.
That's a different kind of purpose. And indeed, beginning in the late 1800s, we started to have breeding for obvious characteristics rather than traits. In other words, it was more important how the dog looked than whether or not it could herd sheep. And so we had the emphasis of breeding changed and led to the distinct breeds that we now see in dog shows and elsewhere.
More on dogonomics when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
The question is, who let the dogs out?
Who let the dogs out and who let them in? I'm Emily Auerbach, back with David Weimer, and we are talking about his book, Dog Economics, Perspectives on Our Canine Relationships, and finding out a lot about dogs and how they're part of our lives, part of our economy, and part of our values as well. I was interested in a section of your book about fads and how if a movie came out like Lassie or the TV series or a movie like 101 Dalmatians or other kinds of movies about dogs, you might see a surge in interest in that breed. Can you talk about different kinds of dog breeds and what drives people to purchase a particular kind of dog?
Yes, the impact of the media is quite interesting. The earliest case I was able to find was that during the First World War, Germany emphasized the German Shepherd as a symbol, and that led to its unpopularity in the United States at that time. But then there was a film, I believe it's called Rin Tin Tin, about a GI who rescued a German Shepherd. And by the late 20s, German Shepherds were very popular in the United States. And there's been research that looks at the impact of the star breed stars in movies on subsequent ownership. There's fairly strong evidence that when we have a particular breed starring in a film, featured in a film, we see for about 10 years after that an increase in the popularity of that breed. People probably remember the first 101 Dalmatians that set off an interest in Dalmatians, Border Collies from some films, Lassie, of course. We all, well, people my age remember Lassie.
There's Old Yeller, but I'm not sure whether that...
Yeah, that was...
that was kind of a mixed bag.
Yeah, that was a mixed bag. I think he was hard of hearing or something, wasn't he?
And then he has to be shot because of the rabies. That's one of the moments in dog film.
I don't know if that one actually had an impact or not.
And then there's more recently the Beethoven films with it. What is that, St. Bernard's or...
Yeah. So it's something, as I said, that has been studied, and often the American Kennel Society has data that allows researchers to trace these breeds over time. And it can cause some difficulty. Some of the popular breeds, particularly those with compressed snouts, actually have health problems. And the theory is that they remind us more of babies.
Would this be like bulldogs?
Yes, the French bulldogs. And therefore, they're more attractive, but they have breathing problems. Some of them have reproductive problems. So there's some concern when we breed in ways that enhance some observable characteristic that doesn't necessarily relate to the health of the dog.
There's so many different dogs, and there's so many different sizes and appearances. If you think of the tiny little lap dogs,
yes.
And you know, Chihuahuas,
and they all came from the wolf.
Yeah, and then the really big ones, and everything in between. It's kind of hard to see in the process of evolution how we ended up with so many different kinds
of
dogs.
Well, it is originally the selective breeding for purpose. That's what got us the herders and the hunting dogs of various kinds. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the focus of breeding tended to shift when we didn't need as many of these dogs for that kind of work. And when people moved from the farms to the cities, well, the dog had to move inside with mm-hmm. them because there was no longer a place outside for the dog. And that began to change the relationship. That's when they began to become more like family members.
And maybe also a little bit smaller.
Maybe size became more important as well, yes.
You talked earlier about your research work on putting a value on a dog, you know, kind of figuring out a cost and what we're willing to spend or think of in terms of the value of that dog. It costs a lot more to buy certain breeds, and now we have these hybrid breeds as well, like the... What is the poodle one?
The doodle,
and
yes.
The, you know, different ones. So, the amount that you would shell out at a pet store or to a breeder would be very different depending on the kind of dog you're getting. Does that translate into a very complicated process of figuring out a generic worth of a dog? You had mentioned like it would be about $12,000 now.
For our purposes, we wanted an average across pet owners. So we had a representative sample of U.S. dog owners, and then we restricted that to pet owners, people who considered their dogs pets rather than working dogs. And the considerations for us were things like the current age of the dog and the life expectancy. You know, larger dogs tend not to live as long. So one of the questions we ask people was about how long they expected their dog to live, which might be relevant to their willingness to pay for mortality risk reductions. And to help them, we actually asked the weight of their dog and the current age. And we told them that, you know, based on the actuarial tables for dogs, this is how long we would expect your dog to live. But of course, you know more about your dog. How long do you think your dog will live? And when we do these surveys, we have to be very concerned about whether or not people are giving us economic answers, whether it's not just some warm glow. So we have to do...
What's wrong with a warm glow?
Well, the warm glow is good, but it doesn't help us monetize the value.
Okay.
If they'd be willing to pay for the warm glow, that's fine. So we do a number of things. As I already mentioned, we randomize the price of the risk-reducing good we're offering.
Like, for example, you would say if there's a vaccine that can cut the risk of this illness in half, but it costs X amount of dollars, are you willing to pay for that?
Are you willing to pay that amount?
That's how you're trying
Exactly, okay. Exactly. And in our base scenario, we confronted the respondents with a 12% mortality risk for their dog from this particular disease. And the main experiment offered them a vaccine that would reduce it to 2%. So in these sorts of things, there's a big difference between certainty and a reduction in risk. But then we want to make sure that they're making an economic decision. So some of the sample were offered instead a vaccine that only reduced it to 6%. They should not be willing to pay as much on average. And that's the case. But we have to do those things to verify that people are viewing this as an economic decision. And we also have to figure out how seriously they're taking the exercise. So we ask them questions about, do you find this disease, exposure of your dog to this disease plausible? Do you find the possibility of a vaccine to treat it plausible? How do you view vaccines generally? Mm-hmm. So economists have to do this when they can't impute values from observable market activity. In other words, they can't use what are called revealed preferences. They have to rely on stated preferences. But there are all sorts of challenges to getting a reliable stated preference estimate. But if we're going to value things like clean air in the Grand Canyon, we have to have methods like this.
How much is it worth it?
How much
you?
Is it worth?
What
to,
are you willing
yeah,
to give
what,
up? Or
what
pay?
Should society be willing to pay to get the improvement? And this was a case where, for people, we rely mainly on how they change extra wages they get for taking on riskier jobs. Well, we can't do that with the dog, mm-hmm. So we have to get an estimate from their owners, how much their owners value reductions in mortality risk. And from that, we back out the implicit value they're placing on their dog's life.
And do you find differences then in that value depending on whether the dog is viewed as a member of the family versus a service dog helping someone who's blind versus...
Well, the service dogs are not in this sample.
Not in that sample.
They're the working dogs.
Okay. So
we restricted to pets. But within pets, we found that people who viewed their pet as a companion paid more. By and large, most other demographic characteristics didn't make a lot of difference. Many of the demographic things we thought might be influential, those dogs didn't bark. In other words, we thought maybe if somebody lives alone, without a single family, single person family, would they place a higher value on their dog? And, you know, it's not the case.
And what about if they had insurance? I mean, there's you can take out insurance to help cover some of the veterinary costs. And
Well, we actually frame the question in terms of out-of-pocket.
Out-of-pocket, so not covered by anything you might have.
And insurance is very interesting. It's pet insurance, which is primarily for dogs, is the fastest growing line of casualty insurance in the United States.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. But it's from a very small base, 5 to 10%. Of dog owners have pet insurance. Whenever we talk about insurance, we worry about what's called moral hazard, that if you have insurance, you take risks.
Because you're not paying for it, so you might as well do that expensive surgery.
Yes. And the evidence, there's not strong evidence that that occurs with pet owners, but there is some evidence that it makes veterinarians more willing to provide expensive services. And so it's a tricky area to sort out. And there's also a problem with insurance called adverse selection, which means people who think they're going to use the service more are more likely to sign up. So insurers have to do things like put waiting periods in and all sorts of things like that, like we used to have with health insurance. Mm-hmm.
One of the sections of your book looks at the sort of the COVID effect, where you have a surge in pet purchases. Can you talk about that and what you learned from that?
Well, one of the important concepts in economics is opportunity cost. So if you think about the costs of having a dog, there are the direct costs in terms of buying food, et cetera, but there are also costs in terms of your time and the flexibility of your schedule, your ability to travel. All of these are costs of having a dog. And there are also companionship benefits that we get that can sometimes substitute for our interaction with other people. And during COVID, the two things that happened, one was people stuck in their apartments alone or with just their immediate family members found the companionship of a dog more attractive. So that increases the demand for dogs.
Sure. If you're lonely and you're isolated, a pet is going to appeal more, and you have more time to be
exactly.
with that
and
pet.
You're home, so you're not, you can't travel. You're more likely to be working from home. You're around. So the opportunity costs of having the dog went down. Now, what's interesting is what's going to be happening over the next few years as those opportunity costs go back up, because now you have to go to work, be in person, and maybe the companionship values change. Although, from what evidence I've seen, it's more likely the opportunity cost driving people away from dogs than the less valuable companionship, because once the relationship is established, it's like establishing relationships with a family member. Mm-hmm.
And we've talked a bit about the sort of the health costs and figuring out, is it worth this vaccine? A whole area that comes up when you're talking about dog economics would be end-of-life care and euthanasia.
Yes. Yes.
And also making decisions when a dog is older about, I guess, heroic measures. I don't know any pet owner who hasn't faced that at some point.
Well, the problem is, dogs tend to live 10, 15 years, and we tend to live longer. Maybe not at my age, but in general, most people have to anticipate that they will have to deal with the end of life issues for their dog. And this is a difficult decision to deal with. I think in the past, the survey evidence suggests this. In the past, people were more open to euthanize their dog when any suffering started. We seem to be less willing now to euthanize to avoid discomfort and pain for the dog. And
why is that?
Well, it could be that we view them more as family members. I mean, think of it, even if your parent wanted to not have heroic measures, if that were not clearly communicated to you, the inclination would be to take whatever heroic measures mm-hmm. you could, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's happening with dogs. And it's not always clear, to me at least, that it's the right thing to do. I mean, obviously, when the dog can be returned to a quality of life, that's one thing. But when it can't, then perhaps the euthanasia is the more humane thing to consider. But it raises issues about who makes those decisions.
And what's regulated,
too. Really, the only relevant regulation now is that the euthanasia should be done humanely, right? But it's left to the pet owner and the veterinarian to make those decisions. The pet owner, basically, but with the assistance of the veterinarian to make those decisions. These are difficult decisions. I think that if I can imagine for veterinarians, this is one of the tougher aspects of their job.
Absolutely. But right now, if a dog owner single-handedly wanted to put down a pet without the assistance of a veterinarian, and there have been some cases and, you know, just where that dog was not a well-behaving dog or was getting to be a nuisance or something, are there laws protecting the dog?
If the death were inhumane in most states, that would be a violation of law. I believe that the actual decision, though, is in effect unregulated.
You mentioned that the cost-benefit work you did on the value of a dog did not apply to if there was a lawsuit.
Well,
but let's say a dog is stolen.
Yeah. Right now, the courts almost uniformly don't put a value on the companionship with the dog, the loss of companionship, right? Which is something that comes up in wrongful death human cases. We suggest in the book that perhaps this statistical value of dog life could be a default value in those cases. So if you have a purebred dog and somebody kills it, well, you could recover the cost of replacing the purebred dog. But just one of our pets, not purebred, it's killed, there's really no compensation because of the court's concerns about how to put a value on the dog. Mm-hmm. Well, at least the statistical value of dog life would be a plausible average value. Now, for most people, it's not a median, but for many people, it's going to be an underestimate. And for some people, it's going to be an overestimate.
And for most people, I would think it's just sort of an intangible. You know how they say this is priceless?
Yes.
I mean, how can you put a price on something?
We can't
it's difficult.
Do that, right? Another legal area where it may have some application is in divorce cases.
I was just thinking about that as to the custody of the dog to measure that.
Divorce courts now in some states do take account of the welfare of the dog in determining who will have guardianship of the dog.
Presumably they don't appoint a guardian ad litem to represent the dog.
I don't think it goes that far. It's mm-hmm. more who gets custody of the dog. But you can imagine disputes over how much compensation the person who doesn't get custody should have. And, you know, this value statistical dog life could be a starting value there.
Lots of things to think about with dogs. And we're going to talk about some amazing working dogs and service dogs when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Now, Red, he's the damnedest dog that I've ever seen. Got a nose that can smell a two-day trail. He's a four-legged tracking machine. You can consider yourself mighty lucky to get past the gators and the quicksand beds. But all these years that I've been here, and nobody got past Red.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with David Weimer, and we are talking about dog economics. We've been talking about many things about dogs, whether the surge of purchasing during COVID or the value placed on their lives, the different kinds of breeds and fads and our different ways of being attached to dogs. Can you say something about both the benefits and risks to human health of our close proximity to dogs?
Yes. Well, in our contemporary society, there are a lot of benefits. The companionship benefit, the social capital benefit. There's some evidence that exposure of children to dogs reduces their risks of allergies later in life. So there are a lot of potential benefits, but there are also risks, particularly for, say, older pet owners with larger dogs. The dogs can jump and cause injury. I know my wife was injured from our dog jumping at
biting.
A leaf.
Yeah, biting,
at a
yeah.
leaf. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are dog bites. And fortunately, we don't have rabies now, but that is always a threat in the future of having rabies return, so, especially if people...
You mean it's not a concern right now if...
In the United States, for pet dogs, it's not really a concern. But in some countries, it still is. On net, I think the family dog probably contributes positively to the health of the family members.
In general, when you pat a pet, whether a dog or a cat, I think they've shown that blood pressure goes down.
Yes.
And can have a calming effect. What about diseases that can be transmitted from a dog to humans?
Really, the rabies is the serious one. There are other infections that can spread. It is a myth that the dog's mouth is particularly clean. That's not the case. But in our modern society, in the U.S. society too, that's not a big problem.
Well, let's also talk about the working dogs, the service dogs. I've seen some amazing dogs in terms of the way that they are trained to help those with disabilities, especially one that stuck out was a dog that had been trained to help someone who was blind go into a grocery store. And I saw a demonstration of this where the dog was asked to go get milk or go get something, and they would be able to recognize the shape of the container and hear the different vocabulary words and be able to actually choose groceries.
Yes.
That amazed me.
That is amazing. And, you know, that's happens. It's probably – that one sounds a bit exceptional. But dogs basically, since the end of the First World War, when many soldiers were blinded, that's when the guide dogs were first introduced. They're good companions. They're available 24/7, right? They're available around the clock. So they're not as good a guide as a person would be, but we can't afford to have people around 24/7, right?
You raise in your book the slight question of, is it fair to the dog?
That's a good question. Dogs in these relationships can be exploited. People who use dogs in outside activities, dogs are sensitive to heat, dehydration. They can be injured. It's like human labor where there can be injuries.
The difference is there's no way to get consent. There's no way to exactly communicate about that. For the most part, let's say it's a dog, and we've all seen them where it says, I'm working, it's a service dog, and might be assisting someone who's blind in crossing the street. Do we have a sense of whether, maybe this can't be answered, whether those dogs enjoy playing that role?
Well, I don't have an answer to that. Probably the success that people have with guide dogs suggests that the dogs find it at least acceptable. My co-author, Aidan Vining, often raises dogs for the first year or two to try to prepare them for further training as guides. Not all of them make it. I'm thinking particularly of one that helped himself to a ham off the table. That was not a good sign that that would be a dog restrained enough to be a successful guide. But there are a lot of other occupations, of course, that dogs are almost have an absolute advantage. For example, their olfactory capacity is much, much, much beyond ours.
So hunting a missing person.
Hunting a missing person.
Drugs.
Discovering drugs. These are things that dogs are exceptionally advantaged over us. And even in finding people in disaster areas, they can go places that machines can't. So they offer us a lot.
And we've also seen dogs used in crimes, you know, canine units. There's sort of this bad history, though,
yes.
too, especially if we think of the racist South and the use of dogs in horrible ways.
Yes, that's certainly the case. And there are different training philosophies for canine police dogs. And they differ in whether or not the dog actually tries to seize the person being chased or whether or not it simply tries to corner. But you're absolutely right. I mean, we have this history. And it could be an explanation for why, when we look at the statistics, there's a slightly lower ownership rate of dogs among African Americans than there are among the general population.
Yeah, because it would suggest that history of vicious attacks. And, you know, one other way that dogs are sometimes used would be with those suffering from PTSD, those that are in hospitals or hospice care, you know, children who are traumatized. In my own program, the Odyssey Project, we read to a dog. You know, children that are reluctant readers sometimes will read to a dog in ways that are magical.
Yeah.
Are there some other types of ways besides, you know, for those suffering from trauma, those who are in hospice or hospital care, children that are abused?
Clearly, that companionship role is valuable. I noticed that my wife, when she teaches, she sometimes takes our dog to her classroom. And the students, it just changes the whole atmosphere. The students love it. So it's easy to see that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And anytime you're out walking your dog and you see little children, they almost always want to come over and see the dog, right?
And sometimes there's initial fear, but then getting past that you know, is great. Although, you know, when you're talking to a child about seeing a dog, you also have to encourage caution.
Yeah, exactly.
Because not every dog should be approached.
And, you know, grabbing a dog on top of the head is not the best way to establish rapport. But it's interesting. There's mixed evidence, but there appears to be some capacity for dogs to anticipate things like epileptic fits or to detect cancers.
Mm-hmm.
That evidence is mixed, but there's something there, clearly. Going back to the support, we had an interesting issue in the United States with emotional support dogs. So the initial regulations governing airlines required them to provide free access to emotional support animals. And this was a problem for the airlines maintaining order for emotional support dogs that were not trained like service dogs, mm-hmm. you know. And it also caused some problems for people with service dogs because the emotional support dogs that were untrained would often interfere with the support dogs, aggravate them in various ways. And services came online, so you could anybody could basically get a certificate saying their dog was an emotional support dog. Mm-hmm. So the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, after a long controversial period, issued regulations that basically required no longer required airlines to give free passage to emotional support dogs. They have to be treated like pets. And you can work out the economics of that as well.
And that makes me think of sort of sanitation and the problem of a dog on a long flight and
exactly.
not being able to take that dog out for a walk. This is not a pleasant topic, but if you look at the environmental effect of all those dogs needing to go relieve themselves out in various parks, has anyone sort of thought about that aspect of...
Yes, there actually has been some look at that. You know, we have this problem with diapers, right? Mm-hmm. I think the norms have changed substantially. When I go around my neighborhood, at least, I rarely see dog feces that have been left. People seem to be pretty conscientious about picking them up, particularly since the city now allows the disposal of those in the trash if they're double bagged. Yeah, that's a problem. That was a problem when I was growing up, and many people left their dogs run free. Both dogs and children ran freer when I was a boy in the 50s.
And we may all have seen the sort of fake gravestones in people's yards saying, you know, here lies the last person who didn't clean up their dog after their dog. So,
well, in Madison, they tend to be a little more polite. Please be respectful to our lawn.
So if there's a takeaway message from dog economics, what would you want people to, after they finish your book, to think either about dogs, about humanity, about the economy? What
well,
would you most want?
You know, as a teacher, I would hope they would have a greater understanding of how economics can help us understand the world. But if they are a dog lover, they're fond of dogs, I hope they were able to expand their knowledge about dogs, because certainly in writing the book, we expanded our knowledge a lot. And dogs are even more fascinating than they might have thought.
Thank you so much for sharing your insight on dogs.
Well, thank you for listening.
My guest has been David Weimer, the author of Dog Economics, Perspectives on Our Canine Relationships. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year. Oh my.